This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 26th of February, 2013, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexis. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. If you thought design was just about chairs, you'd be advised to stick around for the next hour. This week's show is nothing if not a mixed bag, showcasing the very many walks of life that design touches, from architecture to craft to fashion to digital platforms and even the smell of spaces. Yes, indeed. Coming up, we talk skins, skills and the human touch with leather master Bill Amberg.
It's a material that needs to be touched and it has a beautiful smell, you can feel it. All of your emotions can be pricked and utilised with it.
We attend the opening of the revamped Basel Fairground and sit down with architect Pierre de Muron.
So for us, this was the challenge, how to create a public space which is welcoming, which is attractive.
And we'll find out from German artist Cécile Tolas what a smellscape is.
In most humans, this process of smelling mostly happens subconsciously, and there's nowhere in the society we can learn to make it consciously.
More on that shortly. Plus, we'll be tearing round the streets at London Fashion Week with our indomitable high-heeled reporter Nelly Gochiva. We'll hear from Bradford Shellhammer, founder of Fab.com. And we'll drop in on the studio of New York designer Nadia Aron of Knightwood fame too. That's all to come right here on Section D. Stay tuned. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, episode 72. We start this week in London, which recently played host to the autumn-winter 2013 women's wear shows. Our very own associate editor, Nelly Gochiva, trotted around town to see what she could find.
Camera flashes, starlet-packed parties and attention-seeking bloggers. This has been the usual setting for any fashion week lately, which somehow often takes the spotlight off fashion itself and the designers who create it. A day before the closing of London Fashion Week, I took a run through the city to check in with some of the main progenitors of fashion weeks in the first place, the designers. First, I met with Antonio Berardi for a quick chat after his women's show in the heart of London city. Besides working on his regular seasonal women's wear collection, the sought-after London-based designer had also found some time to work on a capsule collection of summer staples, entitled Bellagio by Antonio Berardi, in collaboration with Peroni. It's Monday morning, 11 a.m., minutes after Berardi's fall-winter presentation.
Tell me how it feels for you to be at London Fashion Week. What's the vibe like?
The vibe's amazing. I mean, it makes me feel old and slightly long in the tooth, but I think it's kind of like London is electric. London's always been electric, and so it's amazing to be here. And I think it's amazing what London Fashion Week has achieved, thanks to, obviously, kind of like amazing people that are thinking about it, but amazing young designers. So it's kind of like I'm very privileged to be part of that gang. Do you know, the fabrics are all incredibly light. I wanted them to look wintry, because it's kind of like, you know, there is that idea of tweeds and things that look nice and warm, but in reality people will invest in like a nice coat or a fur or a sheepskin or whatever else, but people wear layers. People don't wear clothes that are hot or heavy or heat inducing. You know, people want light things and they'd rather layer. So for me, it's kind of like it was an interesting way of approaching winter with things that were incredibly light, but that still felt warm.
Who do you design for? Who's your perfect woman?
My perfect woman has curves. That's what I appreciate about women. I love women who are sassy. I love women that are women. I come from a Sicilian background, and it's very much about that. It's about a woman being put on a pedestal just for being a woman, and I think that's what I like to see. I love the androgyny of it as well, and then it's kind of like, you know, we can go down the religious route and Madonna whore and this, that, and the other, and it's... I try never to be vulgar, but I try to touch on those things which I think it's kind of like I've always seen. So, you know, or things I haven't seen, like, you know, a woman really wears the trousers. So it's kind of like there is that fascination, that masculine, feminine, always. I love masculine fabrics because it gives me a chance to tailor, and that's my passion too. So everything has a raison d'etre, everything has a reason to be there. But it's kind of like my woman is a woman, you know. It's kind of like, you know, she has great underwear and she has nice earrings.
I wanted to ask you about something else. Your collection, your capsule collection that you did for Peroni Bellagio,
yes.
Can you tell me more about it?
Do you know, I thought about Italians first and foremost. And Italians are, and I am Italian, but they're a different breed because they always think of what if. So it's kind of like, you know, on a beach, you will see someone, you know, you'll see someone on the beach that will have a cashmere sweater in their beach bag because you never know. You know, and I might get cold when once I come off the beach. And they think of everything. So there was the idea that I wanted something that would be a cover-up. I approached it from a beach angle. Then it was like a bag. Well, everyone, you know, the Italians I know take a great bag to the beach because woe betide you be seen with a bag which isn't chic or clean or the right bag to be seen with on a beach. And obviously sunglasses because, you know, even when it's grey and raining, Italians wear sunglasses. So, you know, there were things that I thought, you know, I giggled to myself, they were very Italian, but really it's kind of like, as you say in Italy, il mondo è paese, which means that, you know, wherever you go in the world, it is like the same town or village. And that's kind of everyone's mentality, really. People do plan ahead and people do think of the perception of who they are by what they have and what they carry, or what they wear. And we dress to impress, unfortunately.
Next on the agenda, in a taxi drive to Somerset House, is the Scandinavian Fashion Exhibition, a showcase of more than 40 emerging and established labels from Denmark, Norway and Sweden. The exhibition also celebrates the launch of a new book, Fashion Scandinavia, Contemporary Cool, created by Danish fashion stylist and writer Dorothea Kundtoft, who has also curated the exhibit. Dorothea shares with me her take on London Fashion Week and walks me through some of her favorite Scandinavian designers on show.
We have three Danish showrooms and then one Swedish and one Norwegian. And I picked the brands based on my book, which is called Fashion Scandinavia. And I picked them just from, also I knew them, but I think their visual profile was great for London.
And can you name some of the brands that we have here?
We have Woodwood here, and Freya Delsö, and Altevi Saomi, which is a Swedish brand. And we have Helia Hammar, and many, many brands. There's about 30 brands altogether.
Tell me more about your book. How did you come up with the idea of it? What is your background in?
I just didn't really understand why there wasn't a book on the subject. I thought it was really strange. And I've been writing about Scandinavian fashion for Days Digital and also Italian Vogue. I've done some coverage for them. And so I've done a lot of interviews with these designers. And I thought, why not just put it all together in one book? So the book is based on interviews with these designers and images from their studio, their background, how they worked, work methods, and all put together.
How does it feel for you to be here? Like, what is the vibe like?
I think it's very hectic, the vibe here. Especially when you go outside and you see all of the bloggers and the photographers. I think it's really increased since 5 years ago. I think it's really insane now how it's been such a media frenzy. But it's very exciting because we get so much press here. Actually, it's mostly press and not so many buyers. So the brands have really got some great coverage. I love Anne-Sophie Madsen, who is on the cover of my book. I really support her work a lot because she's a new designer and it's really hard for her to survive. And right now, all of these designers, they really need investors to come in and support them because the buying at the moment is not so strong. Buyers tend to go for brands that are more established and have, you know, a track record of press. That's why it's so important that they're here at Somerset House now, because the press here is really great.
Time for a quick afternoon coffee and a bite from Tom's Kitchen on Somerset House's glorious outdoor terrace. And then back to the office to work on some of the last pages of our April issue.
A couple of hours later, and it is time for what is known as the sweetest part of any fashion week, the parties. We are invited to an intimate get-together organized by Peter Jensen. Danish-born, London-based designer has picked the unpretentious George and Dragon pub in Hackney to celebrate his latest autumn collection.
The muse for that collection is Viv Nicholson. The first time I was very aware of her was when a friend of mine gave me in the 80s the cover of the Smith album, or the 12-inch that she's on the cover of. And I've always been fascinated by this image, and I thought that she was somebody that I really wanted to sort of, I don't know, do something with it at some point. So yes, that is what the collection is about. So very much for the show that we did in Denmark, we tried to build it up from going from the saying, from rags to riches to rags. And that was how we did the show, with showing fabrics in the beginning of the show, which was very sort of denim, more sort of pared down looks, with a, you know, a little skirt with an overcoat and a woolly jumper and a shirt. And then in the middle of the show, you could really sort of see that she won these money, and it was all with big sequin on the dresses and leather gloves and handbags and things like this. When I started out and when I did my first show during London Fashion Week, which was Autumn Winter 01, it was a completely different scene. It really was. It was something that it was very accepted that you had a venue in a, you know, wherever. It wasn't like that it has to be here and it has to be, you know, it wasn't. I think it's much more corporate now. I think that it's turned into some, which is not, I don't mean that in a bad way, but I think that is the way of the world. But I'm my only fear about this, that way of dealing with fashion, is that people become lazy. It becomes a whole sort of, you know, a generation of interneters, and, you know, looking at the world in that way. And I sort of feel like that maybe it would be kind of nice if there was a whole new generation that came along and said, you know what, we're going to do something completely different. We're going to do something very underground in some kind of way, that people is, you know, pissing themselves over, that they're not going to be part of, you know. And I think that is important. We can't all survive on all the other ones.
But do you think that this is happening, like this underground world, in a way, like underground fashion world? Do you think that those events are happening during big weeks like London Fashion Week?
I hope so. And maybe there is something really underground happening right now, which I'm not aware of. I hope, because I think that's when it's really exciting. But let's see. I mean, hopefully, yeah.
And this is where our Monday at London Fashion Week ends. Until next time. For Monocle, keeping an eye on the catwalk, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
Thank you very much indeed for that, Nelly. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll be sitting down with Pierre de Meuron, one half of Herzog and de Meuron in Basel, and Bradford Shellhammer, one of the founders of Fab.com, will be popping into the studio too. But before all that, we're staying in London. And while Nelly was glamming it up at Fashion Week, I headed off on an exciting little mission of my own in another part of town.
Hello, I'm good. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, and you too. Excellent.
Thank you very much for having me around.
Oh, that's all right.
On a quiet street in northwest London, Bill Amberg has a leather studio where some of the world's more ambitious leather creations are born. These include everything from intricate upholstered doors and wall panels in private houses, to yacht interiors, to one-off commissions for architects including Jean Nouvel, Norman Foster and David Chipperfield. Amberg is a self-confessed leather nut.
It's a material that needs to be touched, and it has a beautiful smell. You can feel it. All of your emotions can be pricked and utilised with it. It's the most fantastic material to work with as well. It's a very sympathetic material for a craftsman to work with. It feeds right back into what you're trying to do to it. You don't fight it when you're working with it. You absolutely work with it.
Amazing. And something like that is presumably because it's a skin and you're working with your hands.
You're working with it. And, you know, so all of the, and then you have all of these kind of strange.
Yes, what are those? That's a bit grisly.
That's piriyaku.
Is that leather still?
It's leather. It's a fish skin from the Amazon.
Oh, so a fish skin is classed as a leather too?
All skins can be made into leather. Effectively, you take out all of the fat and protein from between the collagen fibres, remove all of that, and you then replace that with tannins.
Okay.
And hence tanning.
Yes. And hence leathery old people.
Hence leathery old people. I started to become very interested in leather really as a boy, as a hobby. I grew up near Northampton. My mother was half Finnish. She was an architect. She worked with Alvo Aalto in Finland. And she and my father, who's half Danish, were very influential in how we looked at the world. I mean, I wasn't academic, and they encouraged us a lot to make, this is my sister and brother and I, just to design and make things. Because, so we were constantly in and out of Dad's workshop, but my mother, because we grew up near Northampton, my mother used to bring us leather scraps back from the market because all the shoe companies in Northampton. So from a really quite an early age, I was playing with leather as a just something to entertain. And then as a result, I started to build up a bit of interest in it alongside other materials, woods and metals and what have you. But it wasn't until I started to travel after school that I realised that it was quite a useful skill as a craftsman to have, because I could hitchhike into any town in Australia or New Zealand and go and work with the saddler or the cobbler or the, you know, and so that became one of my little, you know, things to move me from town to town. And then, very oddly, my cousin, who's Australian, taught the leather department of Canberra Art School. Quite weird. And she introduced me to a craftswoman in Adelaide called Gay Wilson, who was absolutely genius. And I worked with her for months and months and months, nearly a year, in her studio, learning an enormous amount from her. So I effectively did an apprenticeship in leather.
Amberg and his team are busy putting the finishing touches to an exhibition called Inside Design. It is the first of a new series of exhibitions held at London's Great Western Studios, each exploring a different material and the process that goes into working with it in different contexts. The exhibition runs until the 6th of March and includes a combination of existing and new projects, with the stories of their design and production told through a series of sketches and tools alongside the finished pieces themselves.
The way the company is structured is based actually very much on the Japanese. I'm very interested in that sort of in tacit skills, and so very much influenced by Yanagi and his philosophies on the way the process of making is so important in the evolution of a design. So here we have a designer and craftsman working alongside each other all the time, and that's really crucial.
And this seems to be something that sort of is gathering a lot of momentum beyond sort of specialist interest at the moment as well. That sort of open kitchen policy of wanting to understand what goes on behind closed doors.
Also, I think it's important that designers work with makers. And so here the workshop is central to the space, and the designers are constantly talking with and working with the makers.
Yeah.
And the makers' influence is much more readily absorbed, because it needs to be. We need to be at each turn in the stage. You have to be listening to and understanding how things can be improved or moved and developed. And as you can see here, each little element is being developed up.
Amberg created his first leather floor in 1986 and has since built a globally renowned, successful business around the material. Working with it, pushing it, discovering lost techniques and inventing new ones. It's extraordinary that in all this time, the inner workings of his studio have remained to some extent behind closed doors.
The other opportunity with this exhibition, even though it's, you know, relatively rushed to put together, is that it's a great opportunity for people to see how the teamwork within the studio works. So just to see the way the craftsmen here are vital to the process, and the designers here are all part of a team, and that it's really thanks to them that anything comes out of the doors here in Lonsdale Road.
How big is your team?
There's 12 of us here in the studio, so that covers both design and making.
And how do you find people with the right skills? Is it a constant hunt, or do people find you?
There are so many people coming here all the time, giving their CVs, wanting to work here. I think within, you know, anybody who's interested in leather tends to find us. And consequently, we do get a lot of people coming in, inquiring about work and whether there's places and opportunities here. And we run an apprenticeship program. We have a fairly formal setup within the workshop with senior craftsmen and apprenticeships. We also take on interns who come here and work here temporarily. But I think it's a lovely place to work. And as I said earlier, it's a lovely material to work with. And I think people do get hooked.
That was Bill Amberg, leather impresario, in his studio there. Inside Design with Bill Amberg Studio is on at Great Western Studios in London until the 6th of March. For more details, visit greatwesternstudios.com and do pop along if you can. You're listening to Section D. Coming up, we'll be sitting down with Pierre de Meuron at the unveiling of the new Basel Fairground by Herzog and de Meuron next.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Architects from around the world are making pilgrimages to the new Central St. Martin's campus to take inspiration from a building conducive to inspiring the next generation of creative stars.
A wonderful thing is when you walk around that building and you see what's going on in there, the energy which the building and the architecture contributes to is fantastic. And I think to have that in the centre of London, which is the centre of creativity, and that kind of investment is fantastic.
Class Act, a film about transformation and metamorphosis, on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Section D, your weekly design briefing here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. The Swiss city of Basel has a fairground that hosts one of the world's more discerning, picky, luxury crowds who flock there for the annual Basel World Watch Fair. When the city felt the fairground needed a facelift, lucky for them, they didn't have to look far for a suitable architect. Herzog and de Meuron, the stellar team responsible for such masterpieces as the Tate Modern conversion, the Prada Tokyo flagship store, and the Beijing Olympic Stadium, are also based in Basel. It was a natural choice for the commission. And last week, just a couple of months ahead of the Basel World Watch Fair, Herzog and de Meuron's spectacular remodelling of the fairground was unveiled. Our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho was in attendance, and he grabbed a few minutes with Pierre de Meuron.
Just explain to me briefly the challenges of designing an exhibition hall space.
Okay, first of all, we have to know we are in Basel. So the challenges may be different rather than in America or in China or in India. So we have here very specific conditions, first. Second, the Messe Basel decided 20 years ago to remain in the city. So not to go like outside, close to the airport, for instance, so outside the city. So they wanted to stay in the urban context. So that was a very important decision. Knowing that, also the fair, who is very successful, you know Basel World, you know Art Basel, so they also are in competition with other places in the world. So they have to keep up and to have their infrastructure be updated and be at the highest level. They wanted to have all the halls connected so that you go by foot, you can go covered inside the buildings, you can go from one hall to the other one. So this had as a consequence to overbuild a public square. This is like a sacred ground. The public ground is sacred. Now the Messe, as a semi-public private institution, came and had like the demand or the wanted to conquer the public space. So for us, this was the challenge, how to create a public space which is welcoming, which is attractive. For this, we opened the building above the covered plaza, and we drill an opening through the building.
So here I see we're looking out from the mezzanine to the square here where the trams are passing. Just explain this void that you've created here.
So it sucks somehow the views of the pedestrians. It sucks it into this trumpet, into this cylinder, opening the view onto the sky. So you have a sort of a sky window. You could call it even or make a comparison to Terrelian art installations, where you frame a small portion of the sky.
In terms of the inspiration for these strips of aluminium that clad the facade.
So we took a woven structure, so bands, aluminium bands of about 50 centimeter height, and those bands, they like textile, they go back and forth in a sinusoidal curve. So, and each of the bands is always different in bending from the one above and from the one below.
Now, the Tate Modern, yes. You've done the old power plant, but then of course now there's the extension. Just tell me a bit about that project.
Yes. It's a building which is massive, so it should also take over the massivity of the existing Tate Gallery. So we use brick in a different way, in a contemporary way, as we open the facade. So it's not an opaque wall, but it's a facade, a brick wall, which has openings, so you give light, the possibility of natural light to get in, but also to have views outside. So you see, it's always about the facade, the element of the facade. How lively is something? How does it look at day? How does it look at night? Different appearances of the building through day and night and through the seasons. Also, there will be an increase in gallery spaces, but there will be mainly also an increase in education spaces. So to widen, like the tasks of a museum is not just to be there and you display art and you have visitors and look at art, but also to have the interaction.
Just lastly, what's your favorite type of building to design?
Most of the projects we are working on have a public dimension, and we want to engage ourselves. We like to be engaged in buildings which have to do with public life. So it is a stadium, it's a hospital, it's a museum, you know, it's everywhere we want to bring in this life and not to make something which is just segregated for a few people, like in a ghetto.
That was Pierre de Meuron, one half of Herzog and de Meuron, with our Milan correspondent Ivan Carvalho there in Basel. Meanwhile, back in London, I grabbed the opportunity to sit down with Bradford Schellhammer, who was passing through London on his way from New York to Berlin. Schellhammer is one of the co-founders of Fab.com. And while you might think Fab.com is just another of those flash-in-the-pan online design ventures, the statistics of its success might well change your mind.
We're 20 months old, so the business has evolved tremendously in those 20 months. So, you know, we went from zero, two employees to 600 employees worldwide. And with that growth, kind of how we find designers has obviously
snowballed,
changed.
Yeah.
And so it started off with an idea of Jason Goldberg, a CEO, and myself sitting drunken at a table in New York City saying, hey, what are we the best in the world at and what can we do better than anyone else? And Jason builds really great websites where people interact with them. He's a user experience guy and a technology guy and a marketing guy. And I love people who make things. And I knew that a lot of my friends were struggling finding a platform to sell their goods. And those friends were independent jewelry designers in Brooklyn, as well as some of these big iconic brands that people wouldn't think that, you know, orders had been slashed in 50% over the last couple of years. This is 2008, 2009, 2010. So from there, I called every single designer that I knew and begged them to let me sell their products online, which a lot of them jumped on the opportunity. Mm-hmm. You know, one of my favorite stories is I was with an old furniture guy, and he said, you should call Milton Glaser. And Milton Glaser designed I Heart New York, and the Dylan poster is one of his most iconic things, but arguably, you know, definitely America's most famous graphic designer and probably the world's. And, you know, he's like in his late 80s. And my friend Alan scribbled his number down on a napkin, and I just called Milton Glaser out of the blue, and I said, I heard you might have these posters in your basement you might want to sell to me. And he said, come over to my studio. And so on day one, we sold signed Milton Glaser lithographs and art. And from there, it snowballed. It was me begging people for the first year, but, you know, now we're selling more than most people's. We're definitely most of our brand's number one online account. But brands are coming to us now.
It's amazing. Yeah. I've got a sheet of statistics in front of me, which shows the success.
How many products a minute do we sell? I love that sheet.
4.3 million products sold in 2012. Well, that's not bad.
That's not bad.
My maths is, particularly first thing in the morning, is a bit shaky to be able to translate that into minutes. But a lot is the answer.
Yeah, pretty much a lot.
I'm interested to ask you, do you think something like this could have only started in America? Because
I do. I think it could have only started probably after the economy collapsed, definitely, because originally we started off as a lot of brands, designers, they get with a retailer, whether it's a small boutique or a bigger chain, and they're kind of married to that retailer. That retailer, you know, dictates where they can sell.
So it's the keys to their success. Yeah.
And so for us, like, the fact that the retailers weren't delivering for the designers allowed us an opportunity to go in and say, hey, we're going to help you. And so that was part of it. But America, our tagline is, or motto, I don't like the word tagline, our motto is smile your design to. And really, that's what Fab's all about. It's like this utopian version. And it's really kind of, we're like these big, dumb Americans with smiles on our face that say people would like design if they actually knew about it. And I think in other countries, people know about it more and are more educated. So we had an opportunity in America to kind of make it easy for people and allow them the opportunity for the first time to kind of understand and experience design. Now, our definition of design is, a lot of the traditional design world might roll, you know, a lot of them roll their eyes at us.
And so what sort of thing is it?
Well, you know, we sell Herman Miller, we sell Veacher, we sell Cartel, we sell, you know, kind of these iconic furniture brands and design brands. We work with, we sell Dieter Rams products, we sell all this stuff. But, you know, we also sell, you know, a lot of dildos and vibrators. We also sell, you know, pet bowls. We sell $10 notebooks. We sell, because for me, it's like, the philosophy of Fab is there's beauty in every price point, in every material, in every product range, in every category, and that we're not snobs and we don't want to put design in a glass box. I mean, I think two people that really, you know, whose philosophies are alive and well at Fab are Andy Warhol's and Charles Eames, and both of them wanted to bring art and bring design to a mass consumer and bring the low to the high and the high to the low. And that's kind of what my vision is. And that disrupts a lot of worlds. It's disrupting retail. It's disrupting design, because we had a designer that said, but I don't want my chairs next to a pair of underwear. And
fair
I said,
enough. I was going to ask about that.
And my response was, well, 25 to 35 year olds shop online, and they mix these things together in their life, and they don't take it too seriously. And if you want your product to get in the hands of a younger consumer base, then you need to work with us. And
is this something that you've noticed, though, over the sort of lifetime, the very short lifetime of Fab, that the people who buy are very young, and maybe most of it's a convenience thing more than anything?
Yeah, yes. 50% of the people who shop at Fab are 25 to 35. So it's a very young consumer base, but it's also very active. I mean, 2/3 of every sale each day is from someone who bought something before. So they're buying,
so
they're and they're buying.
The
yeah, they're buying a lot. And you know, Fab's rise, is it's not coincidental that it has occurred alongside Instagram and Tumblr and Pinterest. Because for me, what we're doing is allowing people to just feel comfortable about expressing themselves. And if you look at Fab, it's colorful, it's funny, it's humorous, it's irreverent. It's supposed to be kind of in your face and loud. If someone can't say the Fab is fun, then they have like no soul, because like if anything I want to do every day is at least have something to look at that looks fun. It may not be what you want, or everything on the site might not be a product that you'd want to buy, but I want to at least make someone like snicker.
Smile.
Yeah, yeah, smile, smile.
Yeah, no, it definitely does that.
And a lot of designers get it. Like, you know, I get great compliments. Like, you know, I said Milton Glaser, but like one of our biggest, earliest supporters was Tom Dixon. And he's just like, I just love what you're doing. It's crazy. I mean, there is this like, we're getting people to get excited about shopping again. Mm. And I think that had gone away.
No, very true. Finally, Bradford, I want to ask if you think that this really is the future of the way that people will by design.
I don't think brick and mortar is going away. So let me say that. I think that is a very special thing, and it's, you need to touch things and you need to experience things. But I do think more and more people are becoming more comfortable with shopping online. One of the reasons is, 25% of our visits every day come from Facebook. 50% of the people who are on Fab were invited by somebody else. People are telling their friends to shop there, and I think that this peer recommendation is very influential, very powerful, and I think that's the future. People are going to rely more on what their friends tell them to buy or live with or what they like rather than what a marketer tells them to. So that makes me excited. But I also think the internet is like, it's just so easy and it's so much fun. So I don't know if, you know, Fab is definitely the future of retail, but I think we have to keep changing. I can't predict what retail is going to be in 5 years. But one thing I will say is retail needs to be emotional, and you need to have a connection, and you need, and that's what I think brick and mortar has. You walk into your favorite shop and you experience it. You're walking, you're like, oh, this is amazing. And that could be Prada, or it could be a cupcake shop. I don't care what it is, but you have this emotional attachment to it. No one does that online. The future for me is people are going to want to feel when they spend their money and learn when they spend their money.
That was Bradford Shellhammer, one of the founders of Fab.com, with me in Studio 2 recently. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll be talking smellscapes with German artist Sissel Tollas.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Ambitious architects, best-in-show builders, concrete connoisseurs, density designers, energy evangelists, friendly foxes, guerrilla gardeners, high-minded historians, inspirational investors, jaded janitors, Kmart killjoys, low-rise lovers, mighty mayors, naughty nocturnalists, office block occupiers, plotting planners, quietness questers, rebels and reactionaries, spick and span street sweepers, transport theorists, urbane urbanists, visiting visionaries, wily wayfinders, exemplary exiles, you and yours, and zero emission zealots. For a full A to Z of the people who make our metropolises rattle along like a well-designed subway and occasionally screech to halt like one too, listen to The Urbanist, the show about the cities we live in, presented by me, Andrew Tuck. It premieres every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24. That's The Urbanist, the show for people who know that the countryside is for softies and that it doesn't matter if you can't find two words beginning with X.
Welcome back to Section D. Now, it's likely you haven't heard of a smellscape, or if you have, that it's something you probably haven't given much thought to. Certainly not as much thought as Berlin-based artist Sissel Tollas. Smell is something she believes, and she's quite right, is too often too overlooked in society. So for her latest project, she set about collecting smells from Berlin, Paris, London, and Mexico City. But how does one collect a smell, and what do you do with it once you've collected it? Our fragrant reporter, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, dropped by the Royal College of Art in London to find out from Tollas herself before she gave a talk on the subject.
As a smell expert, I just would like to ask you, like, how does smell contribute to our appreciation of the space and environment? How important it is?
It's the most important. You smell first, the eyes confirm what the nose find out. But in most humans, this process of smelling mostly happens subconsciously. And there's nowhere in the society we can learn to make it consciously. And I think sometimes it's necessary, it should be consciously.
Do you think nowadays in design especially, is smell overlooked or over-cultivated or not enough? What do you think?
There are smells everywhere. We live in a society overloaded with smells, and these smells don't necessarily are there for a purpose. I think it could be important to change one's approach to smell and also the reason why there is a smell, not just as a solution to manipulate or to sell an abstract smell solution. I think smell is so much more sophisticated and can do so much more than just be illustrating or giving an atmosphere.
And do you think this, the smell in design and architecture, do you think this is something that will grow with the years?
Yes, there is an amazing industry out there who have an amazing expertise. This industry has been used to make fantastic products like perfumes, detergent, etc., etc. But I think it's about time to use that kind of knowledge for other purposes. All what I just mentioned is important, but it also somehow kind of cover up the reality we live in. I think it's also necessary to know the smell of the reality we live in, be it our own body, be it a city, be it a room, before we decide to perfume it or to overdose it with the Granny Snip detergent, etc., etc. So what I'm saying is we should give smell a chance. This we can only do by having access to this amazing industry that enable us to reproduce reality endlessly for the purpose to be aware what is going on there. And at the end of the day, we decide to cover it up or to get rid of it, yes, but not just automatically without any kind of discussion or any kind of thought. That's too radical.
Should the smell of a space be conscious or unconscious?
Depends on the purpose. Now we have no control of it because, I mean, in what smell concern, we communicate smell in our society to perfume ads. Marketing took over with science left. And I think it's about time to bring back science and marketing for a good purpose so that we have spaces where there are smell with a purpose, not just something that are there and nobody knows what's going on. And that's why we're dealing with terms like manipulation here and there, etc., etc. And I don't think that is the way. You know, I think smell deserves much more respect and much more different kind of attention.
I would like to move now to talk about city smells. I know you're based in Berlin. Mm-hmm. Is there something special about Berlin, or how does Berlin smells like?
It's hard to say in two words how does Berlin smells like, but everybody have a unique smell, as unique as a fingerprint, so do cities. I've done several portraits of cities, among other Berlin and part of London, and I'm working at Cape Town, I just finished off Detroit and Kansas City, Missouri in the Midwest, etc. And all these cities smell different. When you arrive in a city, maybe you wouldn't think so because you are not necessarily asked to think so. But if you start to perceive the city from the perspective of the nose, you discover amazing stuff. You discover qualities in those cities you didn't believe existed. You discover qualities in humans and activities performed in a city you didn't believe exist because you don't see them. It's not about the look, it's about the smell molecule, the volunteers that come out or performed by an activity.
And the perception of smell changes, I believe, from town to town. So maybe a smell that maybe in London would be considered awful, maybe in another city would be good. Am I correct?
Definitely, or? Definitely. And also there are, as humans, we are not born to perceive smell as bad or good. This is all education and cultural inherit. We are born the biggest generalist on planet Earth together with cockroaches and rats, and noses there to find food and partners. End of the story. Every city, has its own identity in many ways, and not less smell-wise, you know. It has to do with what kind of kitchen, what kind of restaurant, what kind of private and public, and so many, many issues, temperature, whatever.
And finally, I just would like to ask, what is your latest project in Berlin that you're doing now?
Yes, I just got invited by my friends Elmgren and Draxet, who was talking here, I think the last talk at RCA in London, to do a project in Munich where it's about identity and city. And we're living in a world where all the cities are comparing themselves with other cities. So they are asked to create a project around what is the identity of Munich, you know? And of course, smell is important here. So I do my best to show the Munich people who they are to how they smell.
That was Berlin artist and smell expert Cecil Tolas speaking with our reporter Fernando Augusto Pacheco at the Royal College of Art in London there. And that brings us to the end of this week's Section D. Next week, we'll be heading to Jordan to hear how earth architecture is having a revival. And over in Argentina, we'll visit the only house built by Le Corbusier in Latin America. There'll be plenty more besides, including more wisdom from Monocle's creative director, Richard Spencer Powell, too. So be sure to tune in then. Today's show was produced by Alid John and edited by James Bacon. If you have any feedback or feel you know something or someone that might be good on Section D, do contact Alid at awj@monocle.com. In the meantime, we have just enough time left to round things off on this Section D with our weekly drop into the studio of someone working in design. This week, we headed to New York to hear from Nadia Aron, owner and designer of Nightwood.
We're in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. We're in our store, which is also my studio. The back of the store is my studio, so that's where I do the reupholstery and the textiles. I have a lot of fabric back here. I do a lot of fabric dyeing because I have a bathtub in the back, so I do a lot of dyeing, and I have a hot plate so I can heat up my dyes and make dyes there. I also have a loom here. I do weaving. I also paint, so I have a section where I have my oil paints and brushes and things. And then I have some tools and things for repairing chairs and sewing stuff. The artwork are, they're works in progress. Painting is one of the things that I get to do the least of, so it's something I do at night, like after I work all day, or I do in the morning before I come, before the store opens and things. So they're kind of just waiting to be finished. We built these like rickety kind of bookshelf things to put my fabric on when we moved in here. And so it kind of spans the whole wall. It's about eight feet. And the fabric's just kind of stacked on top of each other. So I have a section that is like mostly dyed fabrics and linens that I've dyed. I have a section that's just like flax linens and kind of the neutral colors that I tend to use a lot of. And then I think a lot of the rest of it are remnants of fabrics that I've used on other chairs or that I've collected from thrift stores or eBay. Like I buy some African textiles and Japanese textiles on eBay. So I have some of those kind of in between all of the rest. Right now I'm working on two vintage chairs. They're kind of draped in velvet right now. They're going to an office in Beverly Hills. And I'm working on some pants that I decided I wanted to make for myself. They're just kind of hand-stitched, like, out of fabric that I dyed. And I have something on my loom that I'm ready to work on. It's almost there. I have two looms. I have one at home, which is a tapestry loom, which is a little bit bigger, and this loom that I have here is a floor loom. It's not that wide, so I can only weave about 26 inches wide on it, but I like it because it has foot pedals, so it kind of, I used to play the piano, so it kind of feels like an instrument, and when I get in the routine of it, it's rhythmic, and it feels kind of, it makes this nice old antique kind of sound that I don't think you really hear anywhere else. So I'm gonna do it for you. I like the clacking of the wood. And it's meditative. If I were actually weaving it, I would be weaving the yarn in and then I'd beat it down. So as I step on the foot pedal, it raises one of the harnesses, which allows my patterns to be different. So that's how I determine what I want the fabric to look like. We like imperfections. We like to see the handwork in our pieces, so we highlight those things. So there's a lot of, you know, handmade qualities. I think there's some kind of Native American, and some people say Japanese, and there's some different ethnicities that kind of show through in some of our work. I feel like my day changes all of the time because we always have different things to be doing, and therefore I don't really feel like I've been able to get a routine down with my work. But probably if I do have a routine, it would be with reupholstery the most, because I have to, that's something that requires many stages and a lot more time and work. So, but I don't think it's really a routine. It just kind of happens as I feel like it. I listen to a lot of music during the day. But something that gets me excited right now is White Magic. The song is Palm and Wine.